Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Welcome back to RCR Greenwashed with Jaspreet and Don. And over the last year, we've been talking about the sciences a lot. And in New Zealand, almost the hearty annual is how is science is funded in this country? It seems to be the hoary chestnut. No one's got it right. Since the mid-80s, there's been different reforms, and there's still discussions about how it's underfunded or not funded correctly. And in 2022 or late 2022, Sir Peter Gluckman said that the funding of long-term and large-scale projects had declined in favour of small disconnected grants. And he basically said that the science system is broken. Now, last week, we saw an op-ed in the paper, one of the papers, and it was written by Professor John Hickford from Ag Science Faculty at Lincoln and co-authored by Craig Bunt, a program director in innovation at Otago University. And they are positing effectively that, the free market approaches do not sit well with science. Now, John, well, we've got John Hickford on. John, we want to start from the beginning here. What really is your beef with the science and the sciences and the free market approach to its funding?
I think the thing is with the free market, it responds rapidly. I mean, markets change. If we went back 30 years ago and you think about cell phones, well, if you had one, you were wealthy. And the technology we have today with cell phones has moved so rapidly that, life's been transformed because of those technologies. Science, though, the sort of stuff we do that would benefit New Zealand doesn't move that rapidly. And so, you know, markets wax and wane. What's popular this year is not popular next year. And then we have this three-year political cycle where any incoming government, you know, wants to invest to make themselves look good. So they try and sort of trap science into three or sometimes slightly longer funding cycles. But the funding cycles are short. And so there's a degree of instability there in science funding. And as we chop and change around with that, we lose sight of what's so important to us in New Zealand, what actually would underpin the well-being of our country economically or socially, as we go with, you know, things that are popular causes from overseas. And ones that come to mind are things like regenerative agriculture, where we've spent a lot of money recently, but there's others there too. We need, and I believe this fundamentally, we need a much longer term vision driving our science of what's of value to New Zealand. And yes, I'm biased. I'm an agricultural scientist and have been for nearly 40 years. It's agriculture and horticulture that drive the well-being of this country.
Yeah, and of course, there's been many politicians try to demean the contribution of agriculture to the country over time, especially in the mid-80s. But heck, we're 40 years on. We seem to still be of the belief, or some sectors of our country seem to still be of the belief that the ruminant animal or the use of the environment is awfully bad. And yet they still want everything that opens and shuts in terms of a social service that the government should provide. My concern, though, John, is I've listened to this discussion for over 40 years. I never really understood it because I figured that, heck, surely these academics can sort it out for themselves and the politicians will be lobbied and there'll be the right outcomes in the end. But what I've observed in recent years, and I've been harangued and harassed for it, is that science is, the output seems to be driven in demand or demanded by legislation almost. Like they assess, like, for instance, we'll talk about greenhouse gases, that we've got a problem with greenhouse gases, so let's chuck a whole lot of money at it for 20 now odd years. And the legislation has evolved around it and advanced all the time, and science can never keep up with the legislator. So in the end, you wonder if it's legislation that sort of is driving what scientists want, when in fact that's nothing to do with efficiency. I mean, as a farmer, all I ever want to know is efficiency drivers. And to me, that could be around genetics, it could be around feed, could be around systems, but if it's around greenhouse gases, that should be around efficiency. And we seem to have lost that in translation somewhere. So it says to me that, I'm going to wrap that line up. It seems to me that political influences, and you did allude to this just a moment ago, seem to be influencing far too much.
Look, I think you're absolutely right. And I just wish that we could, I mean, in the ideal world, we'd leave science to the scientists. I mean, yeah, there has to be political oversight. There's no denying that. But it has to be the political oversight that understands that it takes a long time to develop strength in science. So we've been fortunate in New Zealand in the area of ag and hort science that we've got iconic people going back over the centuries now who've seen the value proposition of ag and hort in New Zealand, understand its contribution to our well-being, and have a long-term vision of where we need to go. Our politicians wax and wane on that one. So yes, you brought up the mid-80s where we were told that agriculture was a sunset industry, which you can translate as apparently eating was going out of fashion, or being, having any money at all to spend to buy the things we like overseas was going out of fashion. Absolutely perverse statement. But we still have that sort of naive belief circulating in New Zealand urban society, especially that somehow we can move on from having dairy cows and that we'll still be able to afford the things we like and so on. And they've got short-term hopes here that, you know, we can, I don't know what the short-term ambition is, but the long-term one is we'd be in trouble if we killed off our ruminant industries here.
Well, that's true. But on the other hand, if there was other industries willing to take up the mantle and be big drivers of the New Zealand economy, I'm not resistant to them. Even as a farmer, I would love another more dominant industry to be in our country so that they could take their, we could all get some sleep and the pressure from the environmentalists just might go somewhere else.
Oh, it'd be fabulous, wouldn't it? But, you know, let's be pragmatists. And no big company really is going to see a benefit coming to the end of the world and going, well, let's set up in New Zealand. The only reason they might do that would be, well, because they've got cheap electricity, to take it a recent example, or because they've got massive tax breaks. And we actually tax business at an astronomically high level. So you can't see big business coming to New Zealand without an incentive to do it. We're stuck with what we've got.
Yeah, sure. And we don't have the population dynamic to drive the demand. But, you know, and on top of that, we had oil and gas bans and we have everybody telling us we can't do stuff for the last 30 years. And so how do we, you know, we're talking about sciences and science funding. How do we unlock this stuff? Is there, what could New Zealand do that isn't so focused on agriculture? I mean, what could they do? I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, we know tourism's sort of good with the incoming money, but it's matched most of the time by the outgoing money. Mm. We historically, we were making about $5 billion a year prior to COVID out of export education, but that's a fickle business, as we know. So look, I can't answer that question of what else we'd do other than ag and hort. It's our primary income source.
Yeah, and I remember 20 years ago being told that the productivity within the farm in the ag industry was terrible. Well, actually, it's very good, and it always has been, especially since we had subsidies removed in the mid 80s. So, it's a bit weird how we constantly get this attack when it is like the golden goose. But look, let's go back to tax and tax relief for a moment. I remember the discussion perhaps 15 years ago that there was an issue around tax credits for science, and it was a political football. I don't know whether it settled down, but do you think tax credits would be a very good way to induce more funding from other parties outside New Zealand?
I think
that's
great.
Useful?
Yeah, I like to separate science into sort of two parts. One is sort of, we can come back to that, is talking about sort of the business as usual type science to keep our big industries running. Then you've got your new innovations where you might choose to invest. And so, you get bright people coming along who've got a great idea. They can bring in some new technology which they adapt to New Zealand use or that will be internationalizable. I think we need to allow technology companies like that and support them, and tax breaks are obviously one thing we could do. And, you know, you draw a parallel. We have given the film industry vast tax breaks to operate in New Zealand. It would be nice to think that we did that with some other industries and that we saw the benefit in terms of their investment in New Zealand society and their ability to generate export earnings, wealth, these sorts of things, that we could provide an opportunity for business to establish here. But we're actually, you know, going almost in the opposite direction in terms of those sorts of things that would create real wealth in New Zealand.
And on one hand, we say we want to have a high wage economy, but we have industry migrating out of New Zealand to where labour is cheaper. So if we want academic labour, we do have to pay higher prices or higher wages. And in effect, we need the payback. And I don't see how it works. I don't see how it can happen while we've got this can't do angle in our administrators more than can do.
No, I think you're right. And again, you know, at the moment, we're awash with overpaid bureaucrats. There's no denying that. But I'd like to think that if we saw overpaid people, they were in industries creating wealth. You know, one great example here, and it's not farming, was if you go back 30 years, 40 years in Christchurch here, which is I've got a lot of friends who went to the University of Canterbury, did engineering degrees, mainly in the electrical electronic area, and went into big businesses here based in Canterbury that were exporting businesses. We've still got Tate Electronics down here, but we had other big companies like Switch Tech, Dynamic Control. They were multi-million dollar companies, and we had an outfit called the Canterbury Manufacturers Association, and they employed young engineers from the University of Canterbury, and they were great businesses. They've basically gone. They've dried up. Yes, they've taken themselves offshore, and they will claim that they can get cheaper labour offshore. But the innovation, the true creativity came from young people trained at the University of Canterbury. And, you know, as I said, they're amongst my friends. Some of them have made a very good living and a lot of money out of what we were doing 30, 40 years ago. But we've managed to kill that. And I don't see why we just need to turn around and offer the tax breaks and the opportunity for those companies to come back and establish here. And tap into all these bright young people coming out of engineering at the University of Canterbury. It's a great resource, that one.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, I actually do recall the formation of the CRIs. I think that was after the formation of the Ministry of Research, Science and Morst and Forst. Yep. I always get the acronyms incorrect. But what gets me is it seems to be, and I've had this said to me by other people, that these entities have top-tier management that seem to be almost overbearing beyond belief, or they've got so much non-work-facing business to do to comply with whatever grant they're after that really it's being overmanaged, all this stuff, and there's a lot of waste in that part of it. Would that be a fair assessment?
I think it's a very fair assessment. It's worried me for many years that how little you know of, if you think about the notional dollar coming into a CRI, how little that money actually gets to the chalk face or the paddock or the orchard to do the work. How little of it actually ends up in the pocket of the scientist who's doing that work, and you're right, how much gets consumed in management and corporate branding and, you know, capital development and sites and these sorts of things. And so they have sort of lost touch with what their fundamental purpose is, which is doing the science and the innovation that would be good to New Zealand. There's also something odd about the CRIs, that when they were set up, the legislation was flawed. They were set up based on the State-Owned Enterprises Act. And so they were meant to go out and become their own sort of separate trading, profit-making entities, and they were accountable to a shareholding minister originally. They, in that respect, they set out really to compete with existing businesses rather than collaborate. And so if you go back prior to the CRIs, outfits like the DSIR collaborated with business. And the scientists working for those organisations went out there, got on the land often, in the case of farming, and worked with farmers to take on real problems, think of new ways of making money, find solutions, these sorts of things. And that went with the CRI Act because they suddenly became inward looking. And I think when we look, and you mentioned Sir Peter Gluckman, Sir Peter Gluckman's looking at the science system at the moment. I think we need to go back to a structure where the primary calling of a scientist who's funded by the taxpayer is the benefit to the taxpayer, not the benefit to an institution. And that sounds like a little bit of a subtlety, but a lot of money is consumed in bureaucracy and managerialism and not in actually delivering the things that you as a farmer of many years standing and me as a scientist have seen accrue benefit to New Zealand. Those things don't happen now. And they're unlikely to happen because a business manager might get in the way and say, oh, but we've got to make a lot of money out of that, and then it just dies. And we've got to go back to this idea, and it sounds a little bit wishy-washy and socialistic, but of public good science delivering public good benefit to industry. So, you know, taking on things. I mean, you mentioned greenhouse gases. That's a focus, and there's a spend there. But there's a lot of other things in terms of just lifting the productivity of our industries, producing things that people want. I was laughing the other day because if you take apples, one of the big focuses in apples has been to make apples smaller because people don't like big apples because they can't eat them all. So I have no trouble with that. But you know, smaller apples are quite desirable in the market. And Plant and Food Research and their business partners have been good in that. And that's a great thing. But it's often them competing with the private sector, and that should not be happening in a country as small as New Zealand. You're getting this strange, almost tension, in a lot of money wasted at times with private sector and public sector entities like the CRIs squaring off against each other when they should be working together to take on the big challenges. It's weird.
So, Jaspreet, I'm going to butt in. I know you're dying to get a question, but I've got this one point to make, last point to make. New Zealand Incorporated doesn't own the apple. It doesn't own the lamb. It doesn't own the droplet of milk. And yet we have this feeling by the state and the state actors that they own us. And that's a concern. So how do you separate out the public good component of what is going to be a private good when it's applied?
That's an interesting one. I mean, the public good component primarily is that these industries create wealth for us. So, you know, we they are. Look, you know, what was it, $54 billion of primary sector exports last year? They're creating wealth. It's nowhere near enough to pay down the debt that we've accrued as a country, but they are generating wealth. They could generate a lot more if we had a system that supported them to do so. So I was doing a little, I'll give you an example. I was doing a little bit of math today. It's an article I'm writing, looking at the dairy industry and the beef industry in New Zealand. Now, as anyone that knows much about dairying will know, the bobby calves tend to be slaughtered within the first 4 days of life. So about half of the progeny produced in the dairy industry are slaughtered to become low-grade products of veal. There's some value proposition there, but they're deemed to be a cost to dairy farming, and about a half of the females produced don't go on to become replacement dairy cows. They too end up as meat somewhere, but the meat coming out of bobby calves or any bull beef that's raised or out of those calves is poor quality meat. Okay, now there's already technologies there existing globally where we could take high quality beef genetics. We could put that into dairy cows here and produce beef by dairy cross calves. There's some challenges in doing that. We've got to be wary not to get too many birthing difficulties. We've got to be able to produce meat that's actually of high quality, these sorts of things. But it could be done. If you did it well, we could reduce the national beef herd. There's no denying that. You couldn't get rid of it all because there's places we run beef cattle where you can only run beef cattle and they serve other functions on farm. But we could markedly reduce the beef cow population, use the dairy cows to produce the animals that are going to produce quality beef, and get the same net gain in terms of earnings for a lower input cost. better emphasis on meat quality wouldn't be needed, and we need to do that better anyway, and a huge carbon benefit, an astronomically good carbon one that could be achieved without any fancy technology or anything that you might put in the feed. All you're doing is making sure you don't throw away half of your dairy calves. The technology's there. It's been tested in New Zealand. There's actually private sector people I know working on this at the moment, but there's a huge opportunity there for us to transform our cattle industry, make big gains in what we do, change our earnings from it, increase our earnings from it, from beef, maybe not from dairy, but from beef, and achieve a GHG benefit too if we want to. And arguably also, if we're going to get rid of beef cattle, maybe achieve some environmental outcomes as well. So lots of benefits in there. It just takes a little bit of, dare I say it, boring, pragmatic investment and what farmers have been doing for many years, which is finding new ways to breed better livestock. It's not rocket science. Yeah.
John, what I believe is the more anything you fund more of, you get more of that. Now, I was about to use a leading term, I'll not use that, but so much of the funding of the last few years has been earmarked towards either greenhouse gases, emissions modeling, regen ag, sustainable farming, all of that. And these are very amorphous terms, ambiguous. Science has to be precise. Yet, as you were talking about the fact that we're not getting more efficient, I think there's a lot of wastage in every council right now across the country, up and down in local government. They are climate change modelers. Every council is undertaking its own emissions inventory, its own sea level rise modeling, and so on and so forth. We have big crown institutes doing the same. I look at it and I shake my head. It's a country of 5 million, a tiny island nation in the bottom of the Pacific. We are not efficient. Far from it. The loss of productivity is stunning.
I think you've got it on a really important, we are super efficient in terms of greenhouse gas production from our sheep and beef. There's no denying that. And it's great today to see that news that we're moving away, we're taking farming out of emissions trading, because we know the faults and the arguments there around the longevity of methane. But we are too prone in government, and this comes back to the long-term funding versus popularism. We're too prone to jump onto the bandwagon of fads from overseas. So, yes, the latest one is Regen Ag. Organics has been a fad for a long time. Anti-GM is a great fad. Oh, it's terrible. It's, the end of the world. We've only had it for 30 plus years and nothing's gone wrong. But we still can't have it. And so it goes on. I always put it down the fact it's a basic human weakness. We like to believe in the unknown. We're sort of spiritual beings in some respects. Not all of us. I'm a scientist. But we like to believe in the magical. And, if someone comes along and says, oh, we can do regenerative agriculture, you've got to feel good about that. Sounds good, doesn't it, Tim? Because if you go, oh, we're going to do some degenerative agriculture.
Precisely.
It doesn't sound great. So this is the sort of rubbish that's peddled, and it's peddled widely on social media and urban populations without people going, actually, our agricultural production systems in New Zealand are hyper-efficient. They're world envied. They're actually in decline. Their stocking levels are reducing across all categories of stock, yet they're producing more value for us. So we're actually doing well. And everywhere else in the world, and I was looking at cattle numbers globally, everywhere else in the world, cattle numbers, dairy cow numbers, sheep numbers are increasing, because the world's population, especially in the developing countries, want more high quality food, and both dairy and beef and sheep meat produce high quality protein, and you don't need much of it to be a whole lot healthier than those people that get by without it. Yeah,
precisely. Now, I came to this country 15 years ago. I come from the north of India, and when I came here, I remember reporting back to you, I come from the agrarian sector, that we follow the rhythm of the seasons here. We dry cows off in the winter. Come spring, when the grass growth grows and the cows' demand increases, we are working like that. Meanwhile, where I come from, Punjab, the government sort of forced that landlocked state, you will only plant rice in certain times of the year, because that's the only thing you're going to give you a support price, a minimum support price for. And that became unsustainable because the ground water levels dropped, but got increased to a max huge amount, but still it didn't really do. The land was not fit for it. Yet here in a country where we are growing what we should be based on the climate, based on where we are, not a day goes by where we don't have some or the other news article waxing lyrical about reimagining food systems in Aotearoa. There was one such article that flashed across my screen just minutes ago. Like, what are these people on about? How did we get to this level of discourse that people can't string two sentences without something, you know, airy-fairy there?
Some sort of buzzword that look, as I said, it's some sort of buzzword that makes them feel good. It conflated with, you know, their desire when they go into the supermarket to find things that don't take a lot of effort to prepare, that are in a packet, that taste nice because they're laden with sugar and other things that aren't necessarily good for you. And they avoid the things that take hard work to eat around the outer perimeter of the supermarket, in the fruit and vegetable section or the meat section or the dairy section. People are bad in terms of controlling what they do. And so when something comes along that offers them a little bit of hope or sounds good, like Regen Ag or whatever else you want to throw in the mix, they embrace it. Oh, this is what we've got to do now. And by doing that, they immediately then turn around and say, the way they make them feel good, that, oh, yeah, but we must be doing it wrong in our sheep meat industry currently. We're
but
not.
There's usually funding to follow there.
And the funding follows it because politicians sit there and go, well, you know, that's obviously something the public want and we need their vote. So they fund it. Therein is the problem, the New Zealand Inc. problem. And we've discounted the value of scientists who could say, actually, that's stupid. I mean, I can sit here as a scientist and wax lyrical about the joys found in the outer aisles of the supermarket around fruit and vegetable and so on else, and the sheer joy and pleasure from eating seasonally grown vegetables. But New Zealanders want to be able to eat asparagus, 24/7, 365. They're fooling themselves. Just look at the classic ones, avocados. Oh, the price of avocados is terrible. And it's like, they're out of season. What part of that don't you understand? This is the problem. And yet we in New Zealand are really good at growing seasonally and we produce fantastic. We lose sight of the fact that our food production systems are outstandingly good. So there's also a degree of naivety. Even though New Zealanders are well-travelled, they're remarkably naive about the rest of the world and the pressures around food and food quality elsewhere. Mm. We mislead ourselves. So, We're off track a bit,
It's interesting, John. You talked about the efficiency of New Zealand ruminant farm agriculture farming. And way back, I used to talk about our ETS was our efficiency trading scheme. It was subsidy-free production. It's the international gold standard. Do you think any politician would take any notice of me for my time in the big smoke? Not one politician, and still to this day, they won't accept that that was a good line. We were already at the gold standard, but we continually allowed politicians to deride our effort. They would on one hand say what good people they are, look at the earnings coming through the gate. At the second, on the other hand, they were saying, let's regulate them a bit more. Let's squeeze them even more. So the redistribution happens from the earnings inside the farm gate. Hey, we have got off track because your article really did highlight the fact the lack of impetus or the lack of enthusiasm perhaps we're going to get out of our next generation scientists. Why would you go into a university and study sciences, and why would you go into a university and study ag sciences? That's an issue, isn't it?
Oh, that's a huge issue. And it's one, again, I've brought this up with put a submission into the Gluckman committee that's looking at the universities. We have a fundamental problem in New Zealand, which is it's a free market problem again. We allow 16 and 17-year-olds to decide where tertiary sector funding goes in New Zealand. Now, I've brought up a few 16 and 17-year-olds, three currently and a fourth on the way. They are lousy decision makers. They're not bad kids. They're lousy decision makers. They go and are influenced by what they see on social media and what they hear from their mates and so on. They never listen to their parents. They're not going to make decisions. Yet their choices about where they go and what they do in the tertiary sector direct where the funding goes. So our university system does cost us, the taxpayer, billions of dollars of expenditure. And it's essentially uncontrolled expenditure because if the kids want to go and do media studies and communications, then we fund them to do that. And at any given time, we have thousands of young people doing media studies and communications or performing arts. Don't start me on that one. We do not have enough going into ag and hort or forestry or aquaculture or those areas that might create wealth for New Zealand. And it's because...
We had plenty go into environmental planning after the RMA sort of got to be understood a bit better in the mid-90s.
Yeah, we had a bit. It's funny because the categorization, even in environmental science, so the guys that might go out and go, look at that, the phosphate levels in that waterway are decreasing. We must have better quality phosphate fertilizers these days because that's fact. Yeah. There's actually not that many environmental scientists. Our kids are flocking into mainly social science and, I would say feel good degrees, where they then come out and contribute to what I call the commentariat. They don't actually do what a university graduate should be doing, which is actually challenging how we think and doing research or understanding the value of research to finding a better future. They basically come out with an opinion. Well, they go in with an opinion. We don't have value. So we are misspending. Now, you say, how do we get more kids into ag and hort? You pay them to do it. And you wouldn't have to go back too many years in New Zealand to see that someone smart, or it wouldn't be one person, but a group of people might sit around and go, well, actually, a country like New Zealand that earns its living from $54 billion worth of exports needs a new generation coming through to support that. So we're going to tip quite a bit of money into that. Not only are we going to fund them so they don't have to pay fees, but we might throw them the odd bit of bursary money or support by way of a scholarship or like that. That's what we need to do. If you then wanted to go and do media studies or performing arts, you might find you face a big, steep burden.
Well, I've got an inducement policy for this, John, and that is you give tax deductibility for their interest component of their student loans for real sciences and real careers, rather than the sort of feel-good stuff that you just talked about. If you had tax deductibility for their interest component of their student loans, there would be an incentive in there straight away. I look at this like this, to be an apprentice who buys his tools of trade to be an engineer or a mechanic or a builder, he should get tax deductibility for his tools. He should get tax deductibility for his tuition fees when he does courses.
Yeah.
That's a bit of seducing that you might do. It would look a bit separatist because I'm saying the performing arts or something that you've made light of wouldn't get that. But I think that's what we've got to do.
I think you're right, because, you know, we get very few into Equart, as we've said. But the ones that are in there, they come out and they earn good money. I mean, they're going out into big salaries. But I make them very aware of it. You know, I've been coordinating the BXI program at Lincoln for many years now. I make them aware of the fact that every year in university is costing them at least $60,000. Now, the fees are only about $9,000. But it's the lost opportunity of being in a university that's affecting them. They're not out there in the workplace already earning money. So and to make up that lost ground takes many years.
Because
many of them work part-time, which also does my head in as an academic, because it's like I talk about work-work balance. You can't do 30 hours at university and 30 hours of paid employment and end up that normal at the end of the week. But we need to induce students to go into the right areas of benefit to New Zealand. Sorry, Jaspreet, I'd cut it.
No, I can't just help but add something that I've come across more than once, John, here. The content of these courses needs to be looked at very carefully. I've come across more than one foreign student, some from my end of the world, spoken to them, you know, somebody working at a liquor shop, picking up some beer, and they see my face and, oh, are you from here? I am. And spoke to one of these gentlemen. I said, what do you do? I'm doing a agribusiness management diploma somewhere. I would mention the institute. I said, so how are you finding it? Not telling them what I do at all, literally. And he goes, oh, you know, New Zealand has this clean, green image, but you would be horrified to know what's actually happening. We've been seeing these pictures in our course. And this person went on and on for 10 minutes about how bad New Zealand ag was. Mind you, this is a foreign student who's come here for a course. And I asked the person, I said, so what sort of job do you think you get? Oh, the government, there's going to be a lot of farm consultants. There's a whole regime coming on. What do you do? He says, by the way, I said, dairy farmer for 15 years. I said, I'd be very happy for you to come onto a farm. But we need to be very careful, especially for these short courses. I don't think the quality is quite there, John.
No, it's funny, and then that goes back, you know, I was talking about, you know, originally we just had the University of New Zealand, and then we split out to the separate universities.
Yeah.
It was driven by a guy called Parry that drove this, the Parry Report, and he pointed out how dangerous it was to actually move to a platform where we had a lot of extramural or off-site students doing short course stuff. He, in the report, it goes into detail on that, saying this is actually quite dangerous. There is a culture around a university with having students there. My beloved Dipag at Lincoln are the classic example. We're having them on site and engaged with us as academics and learning from us is more than just fronting up to lectures. It's the culture that we establish and the attitudes that we carry and the learning they get outside of the classroom from us. You know, we go on a farm field trip or we go on a tour and we'll see something that we look down our noses dismissively at, or we look at something and go, geez, that's brilliant. Those are what inform these young people coming through. But, you know, Dipag, if we have 100 a year, we're doing well. That's probably a tenth of what we need to keep farming in New Zealand going. And that's the problem. But they're pragmatic people. We take them out there. That, you know, I'll give you an example of what I've been on this last few weeks with them is, how do we improve wool quality? We all go on about the low value of wool. Well, hello, a lot of our wool is absolute garbage. It's not worth money. Some of it's really good. And if you want to make money out of wool, you owe it to yourself as a farmer to do outstanding wool. And that's what I teach them. And then I show them technically how you do that, the technologies that we can use to produce value in our wool clip. That's part of the reason why I was, you know, was saying about me talking to India recently. That's part of what they want to do is improve their wool clip. So, yeah, we've got it wrong in education. Tertiary sector especially, it's a mess. I don't know what's going to happen, but we cannot carry on as we are at the moment.
And so I don't want to put you on the spot, but it may do. So just say that you don't really want to answer this. I can't understand how you fit in Mataranga Māori and other knowledge and value systems into your education system. I just don't see how pure science works with that their concept.
It's I can actually do it, and I should send you this. There's a great paper being written by one of my colleagues, Amanda Black. She runs an outfit called Bioprotection Aotearoa. So she's a plant pathologist, essentially interested in plant diseases, and she's funded through one of these centres of research excellence, does some outstanding research, and she wrote recently for what is arguably the top science journal in the world about the fact that science is not Mataranga. And Mataranga is not science. She was very clear about that. So Mataranga is sort of, one of the things I draw, and I might offend some Catholics here, is I equate it with Catholicism. You might go, how does that happen? Well, for a long period of time, it was the Roman Empire and then Catholicism that drove the science that happened in the world. So the underlying moral platform or decision-making structure came out of Rome, was delivered by people who are religious. So, you know, if we take my area of genetics, Mendel was a priest. You know, he was a Catholic and he lived in a monastery and he laid the foundations for genetics or some of the foundations for genetics. The church, the Roman Catholic Church, underpinned what we did in science, and there's a strong history there. Then along came this thing called evolution. Now, I'll say straight out, I'm not religious, and if you come up with something like evolution, Mr. Darwin, you fall out with the Catholics pretty quickly. And that's where science moved beyond the church. That's not to say that everyone in society has their own value system, belief system, and so on that they've learned over the years. And Maori have their own one. That's, you know, we hear about Te O Maori and their Maori worldview and so on. They have a worldview. They have a value system. They understand it. And that is separate to the value system that I might have. And it may not change what I do in science at all. It you know, won't affect how I breed sheep and those sorts of things. It might affect how I were to deal with Manuka honey as an example, because of course the plant that's supplying the honey, the Manuka, is not in, well, it's endemic to New Zealand, but it's also found in Australia, so that's a dilemma. And of course the bees that make the honey were imports, they're colonists, quite literally. So, you know, you have a dilemma there. But, you know, I think it's, all I'm coming back to is that everyone has a worldview. It would be very hard for me to teach evolution to anyone religious, and I do teach evolution in my genetics classes, and I don't have no time for people that are religious. But I think It's just another set of values and beliefs and principles and things that people, you know, once a Catholic, always a Catholic. I think it's people, a value system for people. So it has a place there. Amanda Black, who wrote the paper for Science, said, you know, it has a place in terms of explaining how and why people operate. But its contribution to a lot of the science we do is probably very small. And therefore, it should probably only, you know, control a little bit of the science funding we might choose to put up. Yeah. It's the way I see it.
Right. And good to have that explanation because I see it very simply. It's a dilemma that we don't need. That's how I see it. I'm happy for people to have their value systems and beliefs, but complication. It's just a complication.
I would put money on it. I mean, just Preet, if you were to do science in India, that being Hindu, you'd imagine that there's value systems, everything there that controls what science is done in India. And
you know, what does it do? Like in India, you won't be dissecting a cow, that's for sure. Right?
No, that was what I'm saying.
The holy cow.
Strict Hindus are vegetarian.
I'm not a Hindu. I'm a Sikh. So very small religion. A very devout Hindu will not break bread in my house in India. It's as simple as that because they don't know what's been cooked in that dish. That's what it comes down to. But I still believe when it comes to sciences, pure sciences, they stand by itself. A particular phenomena that we talk of, be, you know, anything, genetics from Mendel or whatever, regardless of what religion, what beliefs you may have, that phenomena still exists as a standalone piece.
You're right. And you know, you see the slight thrown, and Mary will then throw a slight and go, Western science.
Yeah.
Well, I've traveled extensively in the East and sub-Himalayan region, and there's a lot of Western science going on in the East. I can say that now. And it's all in English too. I go to China and I have quite sensible conversations with the locals about science and English, and then I'm lost in terms of anything else, which is talked about in Mandarin.
Because, you know, then afterwards we just come to that same point, decolonize the science, decolonize this, and I'm like, what are we talking about here?
But we were done a huge disservice. If you go back to that listener letter, it was a couple of 3 years ago now. It was turned into a black and white argument. It was turned into a them and us. It was immediately politicized. The Royal Society of New Zealand did themselves no favors with this because they didn't explain what, you know, you could read what Amanda Black's written and you could go, look, this is actually sensible. It makes sense.
Yep.
The Royal Society, for all the esteemed people there, failed to do that. They failed to articulate to the public what the difference is between science and Mataranga. The two can coexist. One will be a hard-fought battle for Maori to hang on to, their beliefs and value system, because, you know, there's many things that colour that, not just science. But science will carry on and won't care about Maori or New Zealand. If we don't fund it very well, it'll just carry on anyway. Western science or Eastern science or Indian or Chinese science, whatever you want to call it, it'll carry on regardless. That's the nature of science. But we can have both, and we shouldn't be scared of having both, the way I see it. Yeah,
and that's a good place to perhaps wrap. It was a great wide-ranging discussion, actually far more wide than I ever envisaged when we started this. But science doesn't have borders in the end, does it? It just doesn't have borders. Once something is discovered and being able to commercialize it and export it, it's sort of perhaps loses its real IP. So as much as we're into, and Jaspreet and I talk about our national sovereignty and local ownership and world, we want our borders retained. My view is that science does work without borders in the end. And then coming right on back to where we started, we clearly have this hardy annual, this hoary chestnut called How Do You Fund Sciences in New Zealand? We need to get you back on in the future, John, to talk about how it can progress. Sir Peter Gluckman's doing his bit. Others like Doug Edmeads are saying their bit. Why can't we just get some common sense or some central points out of it and work with it and give you give scientists the longevity they need to know that they can have a program that works for a long time.
Well, I think that's set national goals, as I said, and pursue them, the things that will be big, well, and agriculture is one of them. Yeah, set yourself some goals and stick with them for 10, 20, 30 years. Yeah.
But I think you have to review them often. As I note in the American model, they review them and reset them rather than just keep chucking money at something that might be a dead end. Anyway,
oh, yeah, I think you're right. Broad goals, Don, not narrow ones. Hmm. Broad goals. We want to make New Zealand agriculture better still.
Yeah.
Not minutiae. Yeah. Yeah.
No, great having you on, John. Thanks for coming at short notice on to RCR Greenwashed. Great to hear your view, and look forward to chatting again.
Good to talk. Thanks very much. Thank you, Jaspreet, too.
Thank you, John.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.